So the chapter picks up just right where the last one left off. Gandalf, Gimli, Aragorn, and Legolas are still riding south. They're on their third day's ride, and it's dawn.
Suddenly Shadowfax stood still and neighed. Gandalf pointed ahead. "Look," he cried, and they lifted their tired eyes. Before them stood the mountains of the south, white-tipped and streaked with black. The grasslands rolled against the hills that clustered at their feet and flowed up into many valleys still dim and dark, untouched by the light of dawn, winding their way into the heart of the great mountains. Immediately before the travelers, the widest of these glens opened like a long gulf among the hills. Far inland they glimpsed a tumbled mountain mass with one tall peak. At the mouth of the vale there stood like a sentinel a lonely height. About its feet there flowed, as a thread of silver, the stream that issued from the dale. Upon its brow they caught, still far away, a glint in the rising sun, a glimmer of gold. "Speak, Legolas," said Gandalf. "Tell us what you see there before us."
Legolas gazed ahead, shading his eyes from the level shafts of the new risen sun. "I see a white stream that comes down from the snows," he said. "Where it issues from the shadow of Vale, a green hill rises upon the east. A dike and mighty wall and thorny fence encircle it. Within there is a rise of roofs of houses, and in the midst, set upon a green terrace, there stands aloft a great hall of men, and it seems to my eyes that it is thatched with gold. The light of it shines far over the land. Golden, too, are the posts of its doors. There men in bright mail stand, but all else within the courts are yet asleep."
"Edoras, those courts are called," said Gandalf, "and Meduseld is that golden hall. There dwells Théoden, son of Thangel, king of the Mark of Rohan. Here, we are come with the rising of the day. Now the road lies plain to see before us. But we must ride more warily, for war is abroad, and the Rohirrim, the horse lords, do not sleep, even if it seems so from afar. Draw no weapon, speak no haughty word, I counsel you all, until we are come before Théoden's seat."
And as Fleming Rutledge pointed out in her book, splendid scenes follow in this archetypal Anglo-Saxon setting that Tolkien had devised with obvious relish. Clifford, we're back for another one.
Indeed we are. We've got chapter 6, King of the Golden Hall, book 3, The Two Towers.
Nice. What'd you think? Impressions?
Pretty sweet one. I mean, not that we've been lacking for fun settings and new characters and everything like that, but this is a very unique setting. We meet new important characters, and yeah, the scenery is yet another just distinct and awesome landscape plot harmony.
I was just thinking about this as you're bringing this up. This might be a stretch, and this would be quite a claim, but these guys might live up to it. Is this the most authentic set Tolkien comes up with? I mean, that's real deal if it is, you know, because that's saying something with Tolkien.
What do you mean authentic?
Like, it feels the most real, almost.
Yeah, in some ways, definitely.
Because, I mean, this is like, Lothlorien was cool, but I don't think Lothlorien felt as real. Like, it was,
right, it's like straight up magical.
Right, yeah.
I'd say it's between this and the Shire, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, possibly.
Because everything else, I mean, we haven't gone to Mordor or Gondor yet, but a lot of places have such grandeur or mystery or something like that they're kind of otherworldly.
Yeah. All right, well, so obviously we got to talk about, what are we talking about today? Well, we're kind of just going in order today. So we'll do the whole approach to the city and to get in to see the meeting with the king. We'll do the whole meeting with the king and then talk about his advisor and then where they go from here. And then we'll finish it up with a little bit of talk about this Eowyn lady, because maybe she'll be important. Maybe. Who knows? But before that, Cliff's Notes.
So, Gandalf leads Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli across the plains of Rohan, making swift time and stopping for only a few hours of sleep. The next morning, as the sun rises over Emmonweal in the east, the southern mountains become visible, and in the foothills between the plains and the mountains, a great golden hall sits on a rock outcropping. The group makes straight for Edoras, the capital of Rohan. Upon arrival, they are stopped by guards who are suspicious of outsiders and under orders not to let anyone pass. Gandalf talks his way through to Meduseld, the great hall of Théoden, where they receive a cold welcome. Théoden, king of Rohan, is a shrunken shell of a man, with his slippery counselor Grima doing all the talking. Gandalf casts Grima down from his seat and brings life and passion back to Théoden. After Gandalf conveys the urgency of the situation, Théoden agrees to mount an offensive against Saruman and send the women and children of Rohan into the mountain fortresses. After a quick feast, the army of Rohan musters, with Éomer freed from captivity, and Gandalf and Théoden at the army's head.
Awesome. Ah, that's a, like, this is a fun ending too, but I guess we should see the beginning before we get there. Yeah, so let's jump into it. So back to this approach, we heard about it at the very start of the episode, but let's continue because there's just so many rich details and plot points and stuff to cover. Oh, I'm so pumped up tonight from that Italian cycling. It's ridiculous.
You're holding the track stand right on the edge of your...
Oh my gosh, dude.
Right on your toes, ready to sprint.
Wait until I tell you about the black jersey after this finishes.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you take it?
Over the stream, there was a ford between low banks, much trampled by the passage of horses. The travelers passed over and came upon a wide, rutted track leading towards the uplands. At the foot of the walled hill, the way ran under the shadow of many mounds, high and green. Upon their western sides, the grass was white as with drifted snow. Small flowers sprang there like countless stars amid the turf. "Look," cried Gandalf, "how fair are the bright eyes in the grass. Ever mind, they are called. Cymbelmin in this land of men. For they blossom in all the seasons of the year, and grow where dead men rest. Behold, we are come to the great barrows where the sires of Théoden sleep."
"Seven mounds upon the left and nine upon the right," said Aragorn. "Many long lives of men it is since the Golden Hall was built."
500 times have the red leaves fallen in Mirkwood in my home since then," said Legolas. "But a little while does that seem to us."
"But to the riders of the Mark it seems so long ago," said Aragorn, "that the rising of this house is but a memory of song, and the years before are lost in the mist of time. Now they call this land their home, their own, and their speech is sundered from their northern kin."
Then he began to chant softly in a slow tongue unknown to the elf and dwarf. Yet they listened, for there was a strong music in it. "That, I guess, is the language of the Rohirrim," said Legolas, "for it is like to this land itself, rich and rolling in part, and else hard and stern as the mountains. But I cannot guess what it means, save that it is laden with the sadness of mortal men."
"It runs thus in the common speech," said Aragorn, "as near as I can make it. Where now is the horse and the rider? Where is the horn that was blowing? Where is the helm and the hauberk and the bright hair flowing? Where is the hand on the harp string and the red fire glowing? Where is the spring and the harvest and the tall crown growing? They have passed like rain on the mountain, like a wind in the meadow. The days have gone down in the west behind the hills into shadow. Who shall gather the smoke of the dead wood burning, or behold the flowing years from the sea returning?" Thus spoke a forgotten poet long ago in Rohan, recalling how tall and fair was Errol the Young, who rode down out of the north, and there were wings upon the feet of his steed. Felleroth, father of horses. So men still sing in the evening. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your first take?
Let's just go through just points of stuff. So Rohan's 500 years old.
Yes. Okay. That's a long roundabout way for Legolas to say 500 years ago they built this.
Yeah.
And then, 500 times have the leaves fallen in my home.
Yeah, and then it sounds like 16 mounds, so they've had 16 kings, you'd assume. And then, so since I've read the appendix, I believe the 7 and the 9, why it's uneven, is because the first line was 7 kings, and then the second line, you know, like it passed to like a nephew instead of a son. So this is the second line of kings, so then that was 9. Or maybe it was the other way around. I don't know, you know. But I think that's why it's uneven, I believe.
Tolkien seems to like 7s and 9s also.
Fair. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the flowers are cool. The speech is sundered from their old northern kin. So they came out of the north, and the one that let him out was this Arald, the young guy.
And do we assume we Aragorn's people currently live in the north? Are these the same northerners that are described?
No, they are not. They are not. We will probably do a special, if I'm being realistic. We're probably going to do a special about like where Rohan comes from. It'll probably be like where Rohan comes from and their friendship with Gondor, because we got cool accounts of that and Unfinished Tales, so... we'll probably cover it there. What's your take here?
I mean, we've got this Legolas saying it's laden with the sadness of mortal men, so it's kind of melancholy, but then a lot of descriptions of like gold, fair, bright, like it just seems like kind of windswept and grand at the same time.
Okay, how about this question? How does this feeling compare to all of the elves that we met in the Fellowship? I feel like this is distinctly different.
Yes, I agree.
Though similar, it's still very different because this is men now.
Right. This feels less like the elves, you know, when you read about them, it's like they're watching the world change in front of their eyes, and they're like, they're the ones tracking the changing of the world.
Right.
And they're sad to see it go. This is more like, it does not seem like they're watching the years in the same way.
Right.
It's just that they're, I don't know, grounded in a mortal existence that maybe is a little bit, has some tragic elements or something like that.
Yeah, and I would add to that, the elves that we saw in Fellowship, they know that the curtain call is coming, as we've said before. Like, they are leaving. That's where their nostalgia is really coming from. Plus, yes, as you said, the world has changed throughout their lifetimes. But the end of their world is finally coming. As we've said before, because if the good guys win, then the three rings fade. And then the elves have to leave, right? That's the reasoning. Rohan, it seems like they are also nostalgic, but they're trying to like hold on to it and remember it, because if they don't remember the songs of their ancestors, then they're going to forget their ancestors, you know, because they're mortal, because they all die. So like, you know, because 16 kings have lived for the past 500 years, like that's a long time for them to try to just remember and keep hold of all the history that they've seen through that time.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me also is they already feel sort of independent. They're clearly grounded in their landscape, and their old songs have references to the mountains and the grass and the wind and the horses. But at the same time, with the elves, there's always references to bits of history in the past and the broader world.
Yeah.
You know, we have a very clear sense of the elves being part of Middle-earth as a whole. This is like, these people are doing their own thing. They've got their own lineage, their own songs, their own language. And we don't really, as far as we can tell, they don't have some strong connection to somewhere else. It's not like the elves have kinship with other elves in other forests.
I think that might be, though, because these guys, they really can't remember anything past the 500 years. You know, like, we might start to see that become a theme. But, like, this Arald guy, he's huge for them. Like, he's year zero for them, kind of, you know? So we've gone over how these guys, the mark is like, you know, Mercia. So these guys are supposed to be like pretty spitting image Anglo-Saxons, right? There's something in like Appendix F where Tolkien translates the writers' names all into Old English, but they weren't actually speaking Old English. I kind of like understand that idea, but it confuses me. So I'm not even going to try to like convey it here. So like we can move on from that part. But anyways, what Tom Shippey was talking about was maybe these writers aren't so much based on historic Anglo-Saxons, though. Like we should get in the mindset that these guys are probably more so based on Anglo-Saxon poetry as opposed to history. Because, like, look at this. What was the one thing that they've been saying here? Or, you know, even just from this page that we read, what can we pick up on? I don't know if we explicitly said it, but they don't have written records. Everything they remember is in song, you know, and Aragorn sings a song. Aragorn, who's supposedly already traveled with these people before, like years before, you know, so like they just remember everything through song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these graves, the Sibyl Mine. What's the two dots? So. The two dots. I thought the two dots over the E is like long.
Really? Yeah, maybe it's long.
This requires a Google search.
It's like bet.
Oh,
okay. I think the flat, if there's Sibyl a flat mine, one.
Sibyl Mina. So these flowers, the Sibyl Mina stuff on the graves, you know, like, those are, Gandalf says it, but you don't know that that's what it means, but it means Evermind or Evermemory or Forget-Me-Nots, you know? Like, this is, like, covers the riders, the graves of these kings. So, like, they don't want to be forgotten. Shippy says, the riders are fascinated by memorial verse and oblivion, by deaths or epitaphs. But, yeah, so unlike the elves, though, who are definitely going to go away, Rohan is in the middle of fighting for their lives. Mm-hmm. And they do want to preserve the history, and it's like it's effort for them to preserve it because they are mortal, unlike the elves, who it's just, you know, just spins through real quick, you know, like they just spin through the years, like Liz said, 500 years felt like nothing to them. Mm-hmm. Shippy also has the good quote here. He says, one should see at this point how far Tolkien's imagination surpasses that of most fantasy writers. Proud barbarians are 10 a penny in modern fantasy. Hardly one of their creators grasps the fact that barbarians are sensitive too. That a heroic way of life preoccupies men with death and with feeble, much-prized resistances to death, which their cultures can offer. Of course, Tolkien drew on his knowledge from Old English, from that literature whose greatest monument is not an epic, but the dirge of Beowulf. And so with that, too, speaking of Beowulf, they come to the entrance. And so now, if you read the entrance of Beowulf to the first King's Hall that he goes to, like right at the beginning of the book, these moments are like pretty like word for word similar. Like Tolkien's definitely emulating this here. So they get to the gates, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the guards are speaking their own language, which basically the Rohirrim speak the equivalent of Old English, okay? So they're not speaking the common tongue of the West by Theoden's orders, and Theoden's the king. So we see another case of xenophobia.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a common theme, but then again, they're at war, so maybe this makes sense in this case.
But key is that Gandalf recognizes it as misplaced xenophobia, right?
Well, we gotta get there.
Okay.
So the guards recognize the horses must be from their own lands, and so they wonder if they're spies of Saruman. Aragorn says that Éomer was the one that lent him the horses. Yeah, and then the guards say, "Of Éomer, I have naught to say," he answered. "If what you tell me is true, then doubtless Théoden will have heard of it. Maybe your coming was not wholly unlooked for. It is but two nights ago that Wormtongue came to us and said that by the will of Théoden, no stranger should pass these gates."
"Wormtongue?" said Gandalf, looking sharply at the guard. "Say no more. My errand is not to Wormtongue, but to the Lord of the Mark himself. I am in haste. Will you not go or send to say that we are come?"
So, interesting. Wormtongue? There's somebody called Wormtongue in this book. He sounds like a wholesome dude.
No kidding. Yeah, I get. We walk into it knowing what to expect from him.
Yeah, just about. Okay, so the guard thinks about it, and you know he decides to let the king know that travelers have arrived. But the guard asks, "How should I identify you guys before Théoden?" And then Gandalf's answer is cool. You want to take it?
"Well, do you see and speak," said the wizard, "for I am Gandalf. I have returned. And behold, I too bring back a horse. Here is Shadowfax the Great, whom no other hand can tame. And here beside me is Aragorn, son of Arathorn, the heir of kings, and it is to Mundburg that he goes. Here also are Legolas the elf and Gimli the dwarf, our comrades. Go now and say to your master that we are at his gates and would have speech with him, if he will permit us to come into his hall."
Okay, so the guard goes to the hall, and he comes back, and he says, "Théoden gives you leave to enter, but any weapon that you bear, be it only a staff, you must leave on the threshold." So they start walking up through the town, and, you know, maybe it's kind of annoying if somebody's somehow listening to this and they haven't seen the movie, but I think the movie just nails the setting.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know what your opinion is.
I agree. Probably, I mean, The movie nails a lot of the settings, but this one is among the most spot on, I would say.
Right. Totally agree. So they come to the doors, and the door warden asks for their weapons. Legolas gives up his bow and quiver pretty easily, but he's just like, hey, take care. They're from Lothlorien. And everybody's like, ooh, ah. I'm a little scared, you know? And then and then Aragorn really doesn't want to give up Andril, which is kind of funny. And I almost thought it was out of character and like almost petty before.
Yeah.
But then I was starting to realize, like, when I was reading it this time, I was thinking, like, actually, you know what? It's not just that he personally treasures the sword. And it's not even just the heirloom of his family. Like, this is the symbol of, like, hope for Gondor and, like, the renewal of, like, the whole kingdom. So, I mean, what if the Rohirrim guys, what if one of them is just a jerk and just steals it, you know, straight up?
Right.
All that symbol of his ancestry is kind of gone. So, like, I kind of do understand, like, why he's just like, no, I don't want to put it in a closet. That's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, although funny enough, you know, if you think of it, something like The Ring, where Frodo might be inclined to hide it or say, no, it's nothing, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And sort of cover it up, not wanting anyone to pick it up and gain the power of the ring. Like, it's not that sort of jealousy. Aragorn's like, don't touch this thing because it's mine. And also, it's the best sword ever. And it's super, super important and really valuable. So don't touch it. Don't even think about taking it.
Yeah. Well,
it's just kind of a funny thing. Like, he could have just set it down on the side and said, don't touch this. Instead, he spills the beans and is like, this is probably the most amazing sword you'll see in your life. Don't even think about picking it up.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get too deep into this, but this does mildly sound like a Second Amendment fight where everybody should be armed, you know? Like, everybody kind of knows, like, God, this is dumb. We shouldn't walk in here weaponless, you know? Like, it's not the situation where you don't want to have arms, you know? But anyways, Gandalf says Mordor's laughing at them right now, and so he easily gives up Glamdring, which is his sword. Remember, he got that in The Hobbit. It's one of those cool ones that glows blue. And then Aragorn sets down Andril, and, I mean, I don't know. That part was just cool, so I'm going to read it. Here I said it, he said, but I command you not to touch it, nor to permit any other to lay hand on it. In his elvish sheath dwells the blade that was broken and has been made again. Telchar first wrought it, and the deeps of time. Death shall come to any man that draws Elendil's sword, save Elendil's heir. Do we know who Telchar is? Telchar?
No.
Yeah, we do. What else has he made? Actually, you're not going to know at all. This is really hard.
What else did he make, Patrick? That name sounds familiar to me.
He made two things. He made the knife that Beren stole off Curufin when he stole that knife when Curufin attacked him in Lúthien, and then he took that knife, and that's what he used to cut the Silmaril out of Morgoth's crown.
Okay.
And then if you remember way back to our dragon special, he made this super cool dragon helm for people to wear when they fought Glaurung the dragon, and it eventually got passed to Húrin, and then it got passed to his son Túrin, you know, who is the one that actually slayed Glaurung.
So,
kind of fun. So this also means, like, this sword's old as hell. I mean, this is, you know, way back in Silmarillion days. Anyways.
The guard stepped back and looked with amazement on Aragorn. It seems that you are come on the wings of song out of the forgotten days, he said. It shall be, Lord, as you command.
Yeah, Gimli lays down his axe, and then they still ask for Gandalf's staff.
Foolishness, said Gandalf. Prudence is one thing, but discourtesy is another. I am old. If I may not lean on my stick as I go, then I will sit out here, unless it pleases Theoden to hobble out himself to speak with me.
Aragorn laughed. Every man has something too dear to trust to another. But would you part an old man from his support? Come, will you not let us enter?
The staff in the hand of the wizard may be more than a prop for age, said Hama. He looked hard at the ash staff on which Gandalf leaned. Yet, in doubt, a man of worth will trust to his own wisdom. I believe you are friends and folk worthy of honor who have no evil purpose. You may go in.
Okay, so, couple things here. This is interesting, too. If we were going to do a section about talking about weapon naming, this would probably be the time, because they were throwing around stuff pretty cool here. There's more name stuff here. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? I don't really have anything besides that we did this.
Like the practice of naming weapons?
Yeah. I don't really know if I have anything to add, but it's just noteworthy, and this is probably the peak of it, because we're hearing horse names and weapon names. And
it's kind of, I guess it's interesting if thinking about swords specifically, because, like, this world, anachronistic world, but, like, based kind of in history that this is set, like, the swords survive people. So they actually have lives of their own.
Oh, yeah, that is kind of cool. Yeah,
they get passed down like palaces do.
Yeah.
And so you think of like, oh, a sword is a tool that a person uses. So obviously it's less important than the person, but it's probably accurate that these swords last generations and therefore like, you know, might actually do quite a bit more battle than any one person holding them. So it kind of makes sense that they're like identified and have their own stories independent of whoever's holding them.
That's a good point, Clifford. The only thing I had as a reference was, This gave me the idea to do. Do you remember what we did in high school?
Yeah, we named all of our cross country spikes. These are the special shoes that you wear for cross country.
They're
little slippers with metal spikes on the bottom.
Right, they're super light, and then they got the spikes to give you grip. But yeah, but like all the names. So the first pair, I just walked up to people one day. I was like, "Do you guys name your shoes yet?" And they're like, "What?" And I said, yeah, you know, you see mine? This is Fast and this is Furious. And then it took off from there, like, the entire team. And it had to be, like, you had to have an "and" in the middle of it, you know?
Uh-huh. I remember the Peaches and Cream. I'm trying to remember some of the others.
My favorite ones were Hot and Ready. Like the Little Caesars pizza.
Uh-huh.
Somebody had, oh, this is a good one. Somebody had a Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And there was like Law and Order, but Peaches and Cream was like the funniest. I think, actually, you know, actually, I did Boats and Hoes from Step Brothers. And I did a pair of There and Back Again in honor of Bilbo.
Mm-hmm. I remember those.
Do you remember yours? What was yours called?
No, I can't. I definitely had a name. I have no idea what it was.
Peanut butter and jelly?
Maybe.
Gosh. We were getting pretty good at those, picking out names. Like, we were actually running out of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, anyways, more importantly. So what was interesting here is, at the end, what decides it that they can go in, specifically, I guess, with the staff, because that was an argument, too.
Basically, that this doorman or door guard trusts them.
Right.
He kind of sees Gandalf as a man of goodwill.
Right. So it's pretty interesting how kind of like autonomous these guys are. Like that first guard too, he had to think about it and he's like, okay, I guess I'll go let the king know that you're here. We saw in chapter 2, Éomer by law was supposed to bring Aragorn, Legolas, and give me back with him, and Aragorn's just like, no, we're not coming back with you. And Éomer thought about it and he's like, okay, you know what? I think you guys are good folk, and I'm going to trust you.
Right. In that sense, this is now the third interaction, the third of three interactions with the Rohirrim, where we've relied on the basically kind of spur-of-the-moment judgment by an individual versus whatever was officially decreed.
And it's because these guys are, you know, weighing them up and they're sensing the virtue in these visitors. Like, these are good people that we can trust and who want the best for us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again...
But it also suggests, maybe more broadly, that they're kind of... I think we said this before, that they're maybe, like, archetypical men. Elves are... like so straightforward, they function almost like machine-like when it comes to this the guarding of things, you know, like they're in perfect harmony and it's almost like they're communicating with each other.
Well, that also isn't like machine-like, that's like angelic-like, you know?
Right yeah, that's not a great comparison. These guys, though, you can see how men are both proud, brave, cunning, but also maybe corruptible, because each one's thinking for themselves a little bit in each of these situations.
Well, like I said before, though, this entrance is based off Beowulf, and I said, like, down to the details. So, like, they did come up to the doors and they had to put the weapons aside. Now, in Beowulf, this wasn't that much of a big deal because Beowulf fights with his hands because he's awesome. Mm-hmm. So, like, he didn't have weapons to turn over. But anyways, you know, like I said, we'll probably cover it in some form somehow, what this entrance was like compared to Beowulf, but I'm telling you that it is like it. So is Tolkien plagiarizing here? No. There's always a better reason than that. And Tom Shippey says, he's saying, Tolkien is taking advantage of a modern, expansive style to spell out things that would have been obvious to Anglo-Saxons. In particular, the truths that freedom is not a prerogative of democracies, and that free societies' orders give way to discretion. I was only obeying orders, would not be accepted as an excuse in the Riddimark, nor would it in Beowulf. The wisdom of ancient epic is translated by Tolkien into a whole sequence of doubts, decisions, sayings, and rituals.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. The guards now lifted the heavy bars of the door and swung them slowly inwards, grumbling on the great hinges. The travelers entered. Inside it seemed dark and warm after the clear air upon the hill. The hall was long and wide and filled with shadows and half-lights. Mighty pillars upheld its lofty roof. But here and there bright sunbeams fell in glimmering shafts from the eastern windows, high under the deep eaves. Through the louver in the roof, above the thin wisps of issuing smoke, the sky showed pale and blue. As their eyes changed, the travelers perceived that the floor was paved with stones of many hues, branching runes and strange devices intertwined beneath their feet. They saw now that the pillars were richly carved, gleaming dully with gold and half-seen colors. Many woven cloths were hung upon the walls, and over their wide spaces marched figures of ancient legend, some dim with years, some darkling in the shade. But upon one form the sunlight fell, a young man upon a white horse. He was blowing a great horn, and his yellow hair was flying in the wind. The horse's head was lifted, and its nostrils were wide and red as it neighed, smelling battle afar. Foaming water, green and white, rushed and curled about its knees.
"Behold Errol the Young," said Aragorn. "Thus he rode out of the north to the battle of the field of Celebrand."
Sick.
No.
That was cool.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Patrick, you've previously said that this might be your favorite building in all of Lord of the Rings. Is that
Did
right?
I say that? No, I said that about similar building. Yeah, I said that about the Hall of Fire in Rivendell.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. I mistook.
Yeah. No, but this one was really cool, too. Like, anytime you get the sunbeams in there, and it's just, like, you got, like, all the history on the walls. Like, if it's a room with a lot of history, I'm probably about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's something, this feels, it's different sort of history in my mind than the Hall of Fire, or this felt a little bit more rustic.
Yeah, the Hall of Fire also felt a little bit more intimate, you know?
Right.
Whereas right. This is like rustic but still grand.
Right.
Yeah. Should we do Medisil itself first?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so Clifford, I gave you the assignment to look up things in architecture that are like Meduseld. Not what Meduseld is like in architecture, just what in architecture is like this.
So, yeah, I will say I didn't do any digging into the origin of the word Meduseld itself, or if that's based off of something.
I believe that was the name of Beowulf's hall in Beowulf. Like his own, not the one that he travels to at the beginning of it. But
Okay. I was going to say that the one from Beowulf, I think, is Hurorot or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Junior year high school.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
So thinking about everything going on here, it seems like there's some Anglo-Saxon stuff going on, maybe some Viking things going on.
Yeah.
And although the people of the Rohan folks are clearly not Vikings, they're nowhere near the ocean, it seems like Viking culture might be best representative.
Yeah.
Like they're maybe at like a similar point in history or something like that. So
if they're based off the Beowulf poem, then that's from when the Anglo-Saxons were still near Denmark before
that's
they
true.
Moved
that's true.
Over to England.
When they were kind of Vikings, basically.
I mean, yeah, or at least northern, you know,
right.
Northern Scandinavian, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so a few different things. For Viking stuff, Viking longhouses are just that's a generic term. If you look up a Viking longhouse, there's a lot of images of different variations on that. Some much more humble than others. And you can see like some have shingle roofs, which is just like little wood slats. And other ones have grass roofs. Oh, and sometimes the grass roofs are like sod, like really overgrown.
Yeah.
And other times thatched. So that's a cool starting point because they mentioned that Meduseld has a thatched roof. So like imagine like grasslands, they're working with grass and it's got this like amazing massive thatched grass roof.
Right.
But then also that it gleams gold, which is like maybe the grasses are really like rich and golden colored sort of. But yeah, the Viking longhouses, I think, is probably the single best precedent. But
what if the thatch was made out of their golden hair?
Gross. another cool Viking architecture thing that is like a little bit, probably the Google images won't do it exact justice, but if you look up stave churches.
Oh, right. Yeah, those.
These are like pretty typical throughout Norway, I think. Kind of overlapping with some of the Viking architecture. And what's intriguing about these is that it was like they're typically built kind of near the ocean, and so it's like often shipbuilders were the ones building them, so they like the insides are like overturned boat hulls basically.
They're very steep.
Yeah, so I envision Medusel as like much more longhouse shaped and less pointy.
Right.
But if you look up like a stave church interior, like you get there's certainly like really rich, right. Like sort of it's like Gothic but made out of wood,
right? Makes sense. Rich carpentry,
right? And that's something that came to mind, particularly like the big like the round wood columns repeated down the hall.
Yeah,
I thought was really cool. And then this is like totally, I mean literally on the other side of the world, but Japanese temples actually have a lot in common with the Viking longhouses and the stave churches. Like that's a kind of another basically like culture of building giant wooden buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of variety in Japanese temples, but some of the older ones, I'm thinking if you look up it's a little hard to translate the names. One that I was thinking of is Todaiji, which is Todaiji.
Todaiji. Okay, yeah. Oh.
This one is the largest wood building in the world, which is super cool, and it's also very old. And like if you get like a far view from the outside, it clearly looks very Eastern with like the kind of pagoda type roofs. But if you get pictures of the inside with like the massive columns and the carvings, it is kind of has some elements of what I imagine is like,
yeah.
It's like dark and light at the same time, like dark and rich, but you've got light streaming in from a few places. And worthy of note is like with some of the Japanese temples, they have like golden elements, like walls or like decals covered in gold leaf that I could imagine having some play here. It's not explicit what in Medusel is actually gold, just that it looked gold from afar.
Right.
But there's going off on a little bit of a tangent, but if you look up, there's something called the Golden Temple in Kyoto that's like literally painted gold. But like some cross between those two Japanese temples, I could imagine is like kind of a similar image as well. Those are all general category stuff.
I think, dude, nice job. I think that was good.
No problem. It sounds like an awesome building. The one thing I was going to say is that the wood makes it sound sort of rustic, which fits with this sort of like rough and ready people. But it's also grand. The one thing that I didn't quite settle on is like if they are really like of the plains, the grass and the thatched roof makes a ton of sense, because like people are always building with the materials around them. Building with like giant logs is kind of what you expect in the forest. So it might make more sense here to think of it as like they're building more with like stone and grass instead of huge timbers.
But no, weren't they on like the eve of glens in the mountains?
Yeah. They're like, I guess, right at the transition between grass and forest. So it's not crazy to think that they'd be working with wood as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other famous thing, you saw Errol there, you know, riding, like they have like the tapestry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of Errol, you know, riding in on his white horse. And then they're talking about foaming water, green and white, rushed and curled about his knees. This is the symbol for Rohan, is a white horse on a green field. So if you look up, if you Google search, another Google search, if you Google search white horse of Uffington, spelled Uffington.
Don't worry, Google knew.
Okay. if you type that in, that's where he's getting the idea. So you see that? So that's something that the ancient people of England just like chalked into the hillside, and that is relatively close to Oxford. So you could have seen this in person. And so like, I don't know if he could if he took like a hot air balloon or something to get like the aerial view of it, but like, you know, he saw that and it's like, boom, that's it. That's the symbol of Rohan.
Cool.
And there's not much more explanation needed besides that. It's super cool.
Mm-hmm.
See, okay. And then the other thing too, they keep mentioning like all these names. Like they mentioned Thingol, and Thengol was his dad. And then there's a couple other guys too who they'll eventually mention, whatever. Anyways, these names, these are just Anglo-Saxon words for king. Okay. So again, another unoriginal name. Like, going theory for me is that Éomer, Éo is horse, and Mir would just be man, so he was just horseman, and he was the first rowing guy we met. Errol comes from the word earl, which in Old English means warrior, and that was from, like, a time before kings were invented. So again, this is like, you know, he's just using pretty basic things, but still super cool. Comes off to us like we don't even notice it, you know?
Right, right. It also kind of fits with the thought that these guys are archetypical, right?
Yeah, archetypal.
Archetypal. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Pretty sweet. I mean, I don't know. He's just so good at that, too. Like, we really should have done that for Lord of the Rings, but I guess we're mentioning it enough anyway, so no real need to get super involved. Should we move on to the main scene of the chapter?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is gonna be a bit. You want to read that that description?
Now the four companions went forward past the clear wood fire burning upon the long hearth in the midst of the hall. Then they halted at the far end of the house, beyond the hearth and facing north towards the doors, was a dais with three steps, and in the middle of the dais was a great gilded chair. Upon it sat a man so bent with age that he seemed almost a dwarf, but his white hair was long and thick and fell in great braids beneath a thin golden circlet set upon his brow. In the center upon his forehead shone a single white diamond. His beard was laid like snow upon his knees, but his eyes still burned with a bright light, glinting as he gazed at the strangers. Behind his chair stood a woman clad in white. At his feet upon the steps sat a wizened figure of a man with a pale, wise face and heavy-lidded eyes.
Okay, so here's the description of our king. This was King Théoden. Just an important note for the entire whole book. The movie decided to make Théoden like somebody in his mid-40s, which I think probably worked for the movies.
Really?
I don't know. I kind of like the actor. Yeah.
I thought he looks older. Doesn't he have, like, totally white hair and a white beard?
No, the movies.
Yeah.
When you first see him, he looks totally white. But then, no, there's an actual transformation.
I wanna...
Yeah, he's definitely... Mid-40s is generous, I guess, but probably spot on.
No, 50s or 60s.
No way, he's in his 60s now.
Okay, anyways,
they make him like mid-40s, I don't know, maybe 50. Maybe 50 in the movie. Mm-hmm. But in the book, if you look at the timelines in the appendices, he's 70 years old on the dot. So, like, he really is, like, very, very old to begin with. Like, the movie makes him look old at the beginning, and then, like, something happens. But, anyways, just keep that in mind for the entire book, because that confused me the first time I read it, having seen the movies. So Gandalf comes in.
Gandalf hails Théoden. He says, "I've come back, and friend, this is the time when friends have to unite or be picked off one by one."
And then Théoden stands up, bent back, but he's still a tall man, and he says, "I greet you, but honestly, I don't welcome you. You're a herald of woe. And, you know, trouble follows you like crows. And honestly, when I heard the news you were dead, I was happy." Which is a cold-blooded opening. If I've ever heard one before.
No kidding.
But anyways, Théoden goes on and he's like, "But here you are again, and worse evils come. So, you know, why should I welcome you, Gandalf Stormcrow?" "You speak justly, lord," said the pale man sitting upon the steps of the dais. It is not yet 5 days since the bitter tidings came that Théodred, your son, was slain upon the West Marches, your right hand, second marshal of the Mark. In Éomer there is little trust. Few men would be left to guard your walls if he had been allowed to rule. And even now we learn from Gondor that the Dark Lord is stirring in the east. Such is the hour that in which such a wanderer chooses to return. Why indeed should we welcome you, Master Stormcrow? Lothspell I name you, ill news. And ill news is an ill guest, they say. He laughed grimly, as if he lifted his heavy lids for a moment and gazed on the strangers with his dark eyes. Okay, so yeah, a couple important things here. Éomer is Théoden's nephew. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we knew that because we knew he wasn't his dad because Éomer's dad, right? Anyways, right. Other big thing that was revealed there, 5 days ago, Théoden's son, Théodred, got killed in battle.
Yes.
So that's a bummer.
In the West Marches.
Right.
Where is that?
We don't really know too much about that yet.
Okay.
But yeah. Okay, so with that, let's keep going, because we gotta get through, like, this conversation and stuff, though we will be continuing to stop.
You are held wise, my friend Wormtongue, and are doubtless a great support to your master, answered Gandalf in a soft voice. Yet in two ways may a man come with evil tidings. He may be a worker of evil, or he may be such as leaves well alone and comes only to bring aid in time of need.
That is so, said Wormtongue, but there is a third kind. Pickers of bones, meddlers in other men's sorrows, carrion fowl that grow fat on war. What aid have you ever brought, Stormcrow? And what aid do you bring now? You know, and so Wormtongue keeps going. He says, you ran off with the best horse the last time. Do you have horses and soldiers now? That's what we need. He adds a few insults to spice it up a little bit. And then he just says, three ragged strangers in gray and you yourself, the most beggar-like of the four. You know, that's not going to be enough. Like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
So also, you know, it's pretty clear we're already seeing, like, okay, here's an evil counselor. And, you know, this is what can happen. This is a warning to everybody. Like, this is what can happen when you got somebody that's good at manipulating people and, you know, defines a false reality for him.
Right, right.
This is this is like Serpent in the Garden kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As we'll continue to see.
The courtesy of your hall is somewhat lessened of late, Théoden, son of Thangle, said Gandalf. Has not the messenger from your gate reported the names of my companions? Seldom has any lord of Rohan received three such guests. Weapons they have laid at your doors that are worth many a mortal man, even the mightiest. Gray is their raiment, for the elves clad them, and thus they have passed through the shadow of great perils to your hall.
And then Wormtongue says, so, Éomer was right. You guys are friends of, like, the sorceress of the Golden Wood. And then Gimli strides a pace forward, but felt suddenly the hand of Gandalf clutch him by the shoulder, and he halted, standing stiff as stone.
In Dwim Mordeen and Lorien, seldom have walked the feet of men. Few mortal eyes have seen the light that lies there ever, long and bright. Galadriel, Galadriel, clear is the water of your well. White is the star in your white hand, unmarred, unstained its leaf and land. In Dwim Mordeen, in Lorien, more fair than thoughts of mortal men.
Thus Gandalf softly sang, and then suddenly he changed. Casting his tattered cloak aside, he stood up, and leaned no longer on his staff, and he spoke in a clear, cold voice.
The wise speak only of what they know, Grima, son of Galmad. The witless worm you have become. Therefore be silent and keep your forked tongue behind your teeth. I have not passed through fire and death to bandy crooked words within a serving man till lightning falls.
He raised his staff. There was a roll of thunder. The sunlight was blotted out of the eastern windows. The whole hall became suddenly dark as night. The fire faded to sullen embers. Only Gandalf could be seen, standing white and tall before the blackened hearth. In the gloom they heard a hiss of Wormtongue's voice. Did I not counsel you, Lord, to forbid his staff? That fool, Hama, has betrayed us. There was a flash as if lightning had cloven the roof. Then all was silent. Wormtongue sprawled on his face.
Now, Théoden, son of Thangle, will you hearken to me? Said Gandalf. Do I ask for help? He lifted his staff and pointed to a high window. There the darkness seemed to clear, and through the opening could be seen, high and far, a patch of shining sky. Not all is dark. Take courage, Lord of the Mark, for better help you will not find. No counsel have I to give to those that despair. Yet counsel I could give, and words I could speak to you. Will you hear them? They are not for all ears. I bid you come before your doors and look abroad. Too long have you sat in the shadows and trusted to twisted tales and crooked promptings.
Slowly, Theoden left his chair. A faint light grew in the hall again. The woman hastened to the king's side, taking his arm, and with faltering steps, the old man came down from the dais and paced softly through the hall. Wormtongue remained lying on the floor. They came to the doors, and Gandalf knocked.
"Open," he cried. "The Lord of the Mark comes forth."
The doors rolled back, and a keen air came whistling in. A wind was blowing on the hill.
"Send your guards down to the stairs' foot," said Gandalf. "And you, lady, leave him a while with me. I will care for him."
"Go, Eowyn's sister daughter," said the old king. "The time for fear is past."
"Now, lord," said Gandalf, "look out upon your land. Breathe the free air again."
From the porch upon the top of the high terrace, they could see beyond the stream the green fields of Rohan fading into distant gray. Curtains of windblown rain were slanting down. The sky above and to the west was still dark with thunder, and lightning far away flickered among the tops of hidden hills. But the wind had shifted to the north, and already the storm that had come out of the east was receding, rolling away southwards to the sea. Suddenly, through a rent in the clouds behind them, a shaft of sun stabbed down. The falling showers gleamed like silver, and far away the river glittered like a shimmering glass. "It is not so dark here," said Theoden.
"No," said Gandalf, "nor does age lie so heavily upon your shoulders as some would have you think. Cast aside your prop."
From the king's hand, the black staff fell clattering on the stones. He drew himself up slowly, as if a man that is stiff from a long bending over some dull toil. Now tall and straight he stood, and his eyes were blue as he looked into the opening sky. "Dark have been my dreams of late," he said, "but I feel as one new awakened. I would now that you come before, Gandalf, for I fear that already that you have come too late, only to see the last days of my house. Not long now shall stand the high hall which Brego, son of Arrol, built. Fire shall devour this high seat. What is to be done?"
"Much," said Gandalf, "but first send for Éomer. Do I not guess rightly that you hold him prisoner by the Council of Grima, of him that all save you name the Wormtongue?"
"It is true," said Theoden. "He had rebelled against my commands and threatened death to Grima in my hall."
"A man may love you and yet not love Wormtongue or his counsels," said Gandalf.
"That may be. I will do as you ask. Call Hama to me. Since he proved untrustworthy as a door ward, let him become an errand runner." "The guilty shall bring the guilty to judgment," said Theoden, and his voice is grim. Yet he looked at Gandalf and smiled, and as he did so, many lines of care were smoothed away that did not return. So yeah, so this is kind of, so this isn't really like the movie, because in the movie they did more of a, like a literal exorcism, because Saruman was almost demonically controlling him. Whereas here, like, yes, Gandalf had some sort of magical stuff as he was darkening the hall and, like, you know, filling it with his presence and using the staff for that, but it wasn't,
it was more
nearly as literal.
More than just pushing Grima aside and taking Théoden outside. It seemed like some sort of bond was broken.
Yeah, but I mean, here it was more so like figuratively and literally, Grima had been keeping Théoden out in the dark, and then some stronger force like Gandalf comes in and he literally just takes him outside, and it's just like, hey, just see. And what are Théoden's words when he gets out there? It's not so dark here, you know. It's not as dark as I thought. You know, he's seeing the storm pass out, and that was like a cool image. And you know, he's seeing like the whole thing. I mean, he still thinks they're in a spot of trouble because he thinks like these are the last days of his house. But you know, yeah, this is, I don't know, it's not as dark as it seems, thanks to Gandalf coming back here and showing him the way.
Right, and it's like some self-actualization or something for Théoden. Like, he sees his kingdom. And he kind of recognizes that he's the king, and he comes back into his own power, if that makes sense. He'd been basically talked out of power.
Right. Well, or like, you know, dark have been my dreams of late, you know, so this Wormtongue guy, I mean, he was controlling his actions and his counsel and thoughts and stuff. And, you know, that's no surprise, because Wormtongue, worm in Old English is, you know, it translates to like snake or serpent. So, the snake in the garden language that Gandalf's using, like your forked tongue and, you know, get on your belly and stuff, like that's, yes, this is like the serpent in the garden who gives you the terrible counsel to like eat the apple, you know? And so that's who they're resisting and throwing away. So, Gandalf, you want to read that part?
"Behold, you are come into a peril greater even than the wit of Wormtongue could weave into your dreams. But see, you dream no longer. You live. Gondor and Rohan do not stand alone. The enemy is strong beyond our reckoning, yet we have a hope at which he has not guessed.
So it seems like at this point, Gandalf vaguely tells Théoden about some, like, the mission that's out in the east, but I don't think he actually names, like, the ring. Like, he doesn't specifically say what's going on.
Right.
Based on details later in the chapter.
Right.
But yeah, Gandalf goes on and he says, what does he say?
Verily, Gandalf said now in a loud voice, keen and clear, that way lies our hope, where sits our greatest fear. Doom hangs still on a thread. Yet hope there is still, if we can but stand unconquered for a little while.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And then there's the narrator himself has some interesting lines there. He says, where now was the, like, he starts thinking about Frodo out in the east, because they're not saying it to Théoden, but obviously this is what they're all thinking about, you know, Legolas, Aragorn, Gimli.
Right, although this is, yeah, like you say, it's the narrator. It doesn't specify that this is the thoughts of Legolas or Gimli or Gandalf specifically.
Right, but the narrator says here, where now was the ring bearer? How thin indeed was the thread upon which the doom still hung? It seemed to Legolas, as he strained his far-seeing eyes, that he caught a glint of white. Far away, perchance, the sun twinkled on a pinnacle of the Tower of Guard, and further still, endlessly remote, and yet a present threat, there was a tiny tongue of flame. Pretty cool. And then it's at this point that Éomer comes out and he offers Théoden a sword, you know, because they're talking like, oh, Théoden, you should, you know, maybe you could remember being a better king if you, like, gripped a sword. And Théoden's like, well, where is mine? And obviously Grima hid it somewhere. But Éomer walks out and he had just been, you know, released from prison, but he already has his own sword back and he offers it to Théoden. Like, hey, or take my sword. Which, you know, this goes beyond the orders of just freeing Éomer. Like, the guards free him, and then as soon as they free him, Éomer's like, go get my sword, too. Like, I, you know, I shouldn't be here. But what does he do with it? He presents it to Théoden as an act of fealty. Even though he was unjustly arrested, he's, you know, as Rutledge says, he's ready to forgive and forget all injustice visited upon him for the sake of a greater cause. Just, like, instantly. So it's like, Éomer, another cool, awesome, good guy. And then this also goes, you know, this goes back to what we were saying about the guards, where he prematurely, you know, receives his own sword and he offers it to Théoden. And we saw, like, the scenes with the door wards where they're kind of acting pretty autonomously. And, you know, we see that these riders just don't have a rigid obedience code of any sort, because they're disobeying orders, like, left and right, you know, from orders that come from the top. You know?
Right, right.
But they're disobeying him because they think they're, like, unjust or unwise or, like, detrimental. And Théoden even acknowledges this one, like, yeah, people are disobeying it, but he lets it go. You know, these riders are loyal, but they aren't governed by, like, strict written laws and codes is what we're seeing. Shippy has the quote here. He says, they are freer to make their own minds up and regard this as a duty. They surrender less of their independence to their superiors than we do. And Tolkien makes us realize that even if they are relatively uncivilized, indeed still a barbarian stage of development, this is not all bad. They can be at once more ceremonious and more relaxed than modern people. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, let's just keep hustling here though. So Théoden ends up saying the really cool verse. I'll just read it here. Arise now, arise, riders of Théoden. Dire deeds awake. Dark is it eastward. Let horse be bridled, horn be sounded. Forth Erlingas. Yeah, and then at this point, all his soldiers in, like, the whole city, because he yelled this just out to everybody that could hear it, they all come and they're just ready to do his will, like, instantly. Like, hell yeah, this is the time. We've been waiting for this. Like, let's go. And then from here, he's ready to take Gandalf's advice, which Gandalf's advice is what?
You have yourself already taken it, answered Gandalf, to put your trust in Éomer rather than a man of crooked mind, to cast aside regret and fear, to do the deed at hand. Every man that can ride should be sent west at once, as Éomer counseled you. We must first destroy the threat of Saruman, while we still have time. If we fail, we fall. If we succeed, then we will face the next task. Meanwhile, your people that are left, the women and the children and the old, should fly to the refuges that you have in the mountains. Were they not prepared against just such an evil day as this? Let them take provision, but delay not, nor burden themselves with treasures, great or small. It is their lives that are at stake.
Okay, and then Théoden goes on and he says, this seems like good counsel to me now, you know? And he offers them hospitality, like, okay, but, you know, I gotta be a good host. Like, why don't you guys stay? We can get some rooms ready and stuff. But Aragorn's like, no. Rohan has to get marching out today. We're going to war today. You know? And then Gandalf says, after the troops leave, Théoden, you can lead the people to the hills. But then Théoden has the lines. He says, Nay, Gandalf, said the king, you do not know your own skill in healing. It shall not be so. I myself will go to war, to fall in the front of the battle, if it must be. Thus shall I sleep better.
Then even the defeat of Rohan will be glorious in song, said Aragorn. The armed men that stood near clashed their weapons, crying, the Lord of the Mark will ride, forth Erlingus.
Cool. So, that's kind of cool, too. So, first of all, Gandalf's council is like, he's straight up like, okay, we got to go fight Saruman with every single man we can. And then after that, if we somehow survive it, there's going to be even bigger stuff that we got to do, but we'll handle that later. But it's just like, I mean, I don't know. It was so blunt and straightforward that it was like, mm-hmm. that's pretty mm-hmm. cool. And then Théoden, the 70-year-old man, he's just like, no, I'm not going to sit back. You know, I'm leading the army. I'm the king. Like, this is how I want to die, you know?
Right.
Which is also powerful. And then Aragorn's lines, then even in defeat, Rohan will be glorious in song. Rutledge points out, the retelling of such sacrifices in song and story will continue to give life to generations yet to come. So it's like, this is the stuff that inspires people when the old king leads out the army. Like, just mm-hmm. excellent, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is what they need, yeah.
And it's worth noting also that Éomer has now been fully restored to favor in yep. Gandalf saying, you should have trusted him all along. His idea was the right idea. And there was only brief mention of it earlier, but Wormtongue specifically among his counsels to Théoden was like, Éomer was counseling you to take all your soldiers away. There are not enough people to defend your borders.
Well, so I mean, that leads into the next scene here, because they bring out Théoden's own sword. And then Grima's coming out too, Wormtongue, he's coming out. And mm-hmm. Wormtongue, he's still, you know, now he's trying to go along with the king's wishes that are clearly influenced by Gandalf, mm-hmm. but he's still trying to coddle the king into doing nothing. You know, like, he's throwing out stuff like, Théoden, your lunch is ready. You know, just sit down, have a little meal, you can rethink this, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, kind of babying him almost, you mm-hmm. know? And Wormtongue, he's alarmed that they're all going to go to war, and he thinks Gandalf's even, like, bewitched him or something. But then Théoden says, if this is bewitchment, said Théoden, it seems to me more wholesome than your whisperings. Your leechcraft ere long would have had me walking on all fours like a beast. No, not one shall be left, not even Grima. Grima shall ride too. Go, you have yet time to clean the rust from your sword. Which, that's a good insult, you know, a rusty sword back in the day. I bet that mm-hmm. would have gotten the people, you know, red in the face mm-hmm, hearing mm-hmm. that insult. Obviously, it goes like, yeah, Grima doesn't use his sword very often. If you were picking up on that. Grima says he doesn't want to be parted from Théoden's side, to which Théoden responds like, well, you won't be, because I'm going to go to war too. Now you can come and prove yourself faithful. But then Grima keeps trying to barter his way out of not going to war and stuff. And what does Gandalf say?
Grima says, okay, fine. If you're going to war, appoint me as your steward, and I'll look after your kingdom for you.
yeah, even better. Yeah.
And eventually, Gandalf responds, he is bold and cunning. Even now he plays a game with peril and wins a throw. Hours of my precious time he has wasted already. Down, snake, he said suddenly in a terrible voice. Down on your belly. How long is it since Saruman bought you? What was the promised price? When all the men were dead, you were to pick your share of the treasure and take the woman you desire? Too long have you watched her under your eyelids and haunted her steps.
So the woman's Aowen, but we'll talk about that at the end. Yeah, so Gandalf clearly is accusing Wormtongue of working for Saruman. Grima says, you lie. And then Gandalf, he continues.
That word comes too oft and easy from your lips, said Gandalf. I do not lie. See, Théoden, here is a snake. With safety, you cannot take it with you, nor can you leave it behind. To slay it would be just, but it was not always as it is now. Once it was a man, and did you service in its fashion. Give him a horse and let him go at once, wherever he chooses. By his choice, you shall judge him.
So yeah, so Théoden's goes on, he's just like, got it, Wormtongue? You know, you hear this? We're going to give you a horse, and balls in your court to be loyal to me. So despite all the evil counsels that Grima's given, they're still going to give him a chance to redeem himself right here, right now, which is mm-hmm. kind of cool, too. But what does Grima do?
His hands are working, and his eyes glitter, and he bares his teeth and hisses at them and then spits at the king's feet and darts to one side and flees down the stairs.
Yeah, and when he runs away, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when he runs away, the guards wash the stones that he was standing on because they feel they're so defiled.
Yes. Well, and the stones he spit on, right?
Yeah. And so, obviously the serpent talk, you know, is at its peak here.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the serpent in the garden, or like Satan, or like Melkor in the special, it's like they make a point to say, like, once he was a man, you know, and did you service in its fashion, you know, but now he's just become something else. Like, he's degenerated into something else.
And kind of interesting here that Gandalf sort of gives Théoden the go-ahead to say, like, you could probably kill him and it would be totally justified. In an alternate version of this, if Théoden just chopped off Grima's head right there, it wouldn't have been that shocking. Although that would be kind of out of keeping with Lord of the Rings in general. We wouldn't read that as crazy.
I thought Gandalf was just like, no, just let him choose. Like, and if he goes away, it's like, well, then we know he was a bad guy, you know?
Right. He's saying it would be just to slay him.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to remember that he was once a man. And so he counsels mercy, basically.
Right.
Which is definitely in keeping with Gandalf throughout the story. It's sort of what we expect, is like he has no respect of any sort for this creature.
Yeah.
And yet he's still basically counseling Théoden that he could be, he's still like a life, a living, you know, still a life, basically.
Yeah, but Wormtongue chooses to be Judas, you know, he's not Peter, St. Peter, who, you know, redeems himself. He's the loser, the failure. And like, I don't know, I think we've had the conversation before, like, you only remember like the famous people that do succeed or stuff and stuff. That's not quite the conversation that we had, but like, there's definitely memorable traitors and failures, you know, people that didn't heed the warning or screwed up and like didn't redeem themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In history. And like, Grima goes down as one of them. Mm-hmm. With like, you know, Judas, Benedict Arnold, or Maeglin from the Silmarillion. You know? Mm-hmm. Let's just blow through the rest of this, though. Let's get it done. So they have lunch. Gandalf and Théoden are talking about Saruman. They're saying, like, who knows when Saruman first betrayed us, but, you know, he installed Grima to be a spy and to counsel you to bad ends, right? And then Théoden thanks Gandalf and demands he asks for a gift. So Gandalf asks, like, well, can I permanently keep Shadowfax? Because I only borrowed him the last time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli all get a bunch of cool gear for war. It was a good paragraph, but let's keep going. And then Théoden says he gets out to the whole people, and he says, let me see. Behold, I go forth. And it seems like to be my last riding, said Théoden. I have no child. Théodred, my son, is slain. I name Éomer, my sister's son, to be my heir. If neither of us return, then choose a new lord as you will. But to someone I now must entrust my people that I leave behind to rule in my place. Which of you will stay? And so then none of the men speak, but eventually after some prompting, they're like, well, how about Éowyn? You know, because she's your niece and she can lead our people. And we're going to talk about Éowyn in a little bit here. So then they all get the horses ready. Théoden's horse is named Snowmane. That'll be mildly important for the future. And then Éomer invites Gimli to ride on his horse with him, which his horse is named Firefoot. That's kind of a cool name for a horse.
Mm-hmm.
But this was to mend hostilities from their very first meeting, because, I don't know, it was Éomer and Gimli go way back. Shadowfax has a cool entrance. Théoden proclaims a gift of Shadowfax to Gandalf. Gandalf shows off his white robes, and they all set off. We're kind of shafting Shadowfax these past chapters, but that's the reality. Read it yourselves. And the chapter ends with Éowyn watching them go.
Mm-hmm.
So this Éowyn lady, let's not spend too much time because this has kind of been long, but where have we seen her? We saw her when she first came outside, and then do you want to read that quote from page 504? This is when like Théoden walks outside and she's like, no, sister, daughter, you can go out. Like,
well, I got this. Yeah, she was standing behind Théoden's throne inside the hall. Right, and then she follows them out, but Théoden says, "Go, Éowyn, sister daughter," said the old king. "The time for fear is past." The woman turned and went slowly into the house. As she passed the door, she turned and looked back. Grave and thoughtful was her glance as she looked on the king with cool pity in her eyes. Very fair was her face, and her long hair was like a river of gold. Slender and tall she was, in her white robe girt with silver, but strong she seemed and stern as steel, a daughter of kings. Thus Aragorn, for the first time in the full light of day, beheld Éowyn, Lady of Rohan, and thought her fair, fair and cold, like the morning of a pale spring that has not yet come to womanhood. And she now was suddenly aware of him, tall heir of kings, wise with many winters, gray-cloaked, hiding a power that yet she felt. For a moment still as stone she stood, then turning swiftly she was gone.
Mm. Right, and so then we were hearing that Grima, you know, part of his deal, if he had succeeded, he would have probably wanted to take her as wife. So we're getting the idea that, like, she's a very attractive lady.
Mm-hmm. And she is Éomer's sister, right?
Yes, yeah, so the king's niece, Éomer's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a paragraph somewhere in 511 here that we should read too. So Théoden drank from a cup, and she then proffered it to the guests. As she stood before Aragorn, she passed suddenly and looked upon him, and her eyes were shining. And he looked down upon her fair face and smiled. But as he took the cup, his hand met hers, and he knew that she trembled at the touch. "Hail, Aragorn, son of Arathorn," she said. "Hail, Lady of Rohan," he answered, but his face was now troubled and did not smile. So we're definitely starting to pick up that there's, you know, attraction between probably both of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is weird because Aragorn as... Well, I guess we haven't really formally talked about it, but Aragorn and Arwen are a thing back in Rivendell.
Right, and we did talk about it in Lothlorien because right. Galadriel is sort of... Aragorn's grandmother-in-law, right?
To be, yeah.
Right, grandmother-in-law to be. Yeah. So we get the suggestion that Eowyn has her sights on Aragorn. Aragorn thinks she's attractive, but then gets a little... He frowns, basically. We can assume that he's uncomfortable or unhappy with himself for being attracted to her when they have this interaction with this chalice.
Right. Very small, you know, scenes about it, but mm-hmm. this lays the groundwork for, you know, a story about Eowyn, I guess.
Well, I one other little thing about her, it is worth noting that Hama, the original guard of the palace of Medusel's, when Théoden is trying to think of who's going to lead his people once he goes off to war, and he's like, oh, I don't know who it's going to be, I don't have a direct heir in my house. And the guard suggests her because he says, "I said not Éomer," answered Hama, "and he is not the last. There is Eowyn, daughter of Éomund, his sister. She is fearless and high-hearted. All love her. Let her be as lord to the heir Lingus while we are gone." And then Théoden immediately agrees. So it's clear that she's well-respected, both from like a, what I guess you would... We would imagine like typically like the womanly role is like, oh, everybody in the city loves her, but... Clearly she's kind of like has a warrior heart as well and is respected among the kings and warriors of the group.
Yeah, she might not just be good at just sewing.
That is the suggestion here.
Okay, I think that should be good for that. All right, Clifford, this weekend, I guess, we're going to come out with a Beowulf special since, you know, the Riders of Rohan, we were talking about the similarities here. So got the whole thing. At this point, we've loosely been encouraging everybody to read with us throughout this series. No idea if people have or not. But in addition to that, we would encourage people to read Beowulf this week with us. It seems like that seems like a big task, but this book is not that long. Like, you could probably whip through it in a couple of days.
Also, you may have had to read it in English class or something like that. British lit.
Yeah.
It's worth digging up. If you've got it buried on your shelf somewhere, it's worth pulling out. Because I recalled reading it in high school, but it was much more rewarding reading it again now with a different lens and a little bit more patience.
Now that said, though, I knew we were doing this all week. Like, all right, I got to read Beowulf and get ready for this. And so, like, a week ago, I was starting to do that. And there was one time, it was like, of like, I don't know, it was like a Thursday evening or something, and I pull it out and I read the first page and I'm just like, nope, I can't do this. I just put it down. Like, it's like just not happening tonight. So like, this is something like when you read this kind of stuff, you have to be in the mood for it, you know, and you gotta set the right mood. That doesn't mean you gotta go out on like a Viking ship on the North Sea to be able to read Beowulf, but I mean, I don't know, for me, I do need to get the setup right. So I don't know, like, do you have the same experience with that?
I definitely had to be in the right headspace. I agree. Like, you have to be, you can't just think you're going to read it at the same pace or in the same casual way you might read a book for fun.
Right.
You really have to be drilling into it in a different way.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I'm a morning person, so it's like, okay, this is only getting done in the morning. I'm not even going to attempt past noon in any situation. Okay. And then also, like, at this point, what I've discovered is I never drank coffee before, but now I drink it when I'm going to read something, like, really intense like this. Mm. Like, it's like I use it as, like, a stimulant or, like, Adderall, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'll never rely on coffee to, like, wake up in the morning because that's lame. But it's, you know, to really dig deep into, like, a good meaty text. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. this will help me focus. And I also usually, what I also do too, is I usually throw on classical music in the background just so that I can really zone everything else out and like mm-hmm. have that helping me just get in the zone. For this one, just, you know, and for Beowulf in particular, just what I was in the mood to listen to or just discovered was Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. It got me through the entire book.
Okay, sweet. So,
I don't know, do you have anything like that or... It's cool if not.
I would say, like, you know, when you're reading and you get imagery in your head from whatever you're reading, you know, yeah. as you're following along with the story. With this, I feel like I have to make a very conscious effort to bring the same images to mind. It's like it doesn't come as naturally, but that really helped me work my way through it. Was like even pausing every two lines and just trying to construct whatever picture the story was trying to tell. Because if I were to read at the normal pace, I would read a book. It would just be words, you know, just kind of flying by. Words, names, actions. And I wouldn't have any sense. I wouldn't be able to see anything. So I tried to pause every now and then and try to, like, you know, close my eyes and envision what they're talking about.
Mm. Well, so you had to do a lot of pauses then.
I mean, it comes here and there. It's like I mostly have to check myself to make sure that I am seeing what they're talking about. Because... Yeah. There'd be times when I'd realize that I wasn't seeing anything, you know, and I'd have to go back and reread a chunk. Yeah. But other times I'd be really sucked into it and it would feel pretty smooth.
Right. I feel like, you know, in high school I probably absorbed, I don't know, 15% of the book, you know, whereas this time I think I got more like 75 or 80, which I think is pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Somebody like Tolkien, I don't know, even, you know, it was my second read of it, I guess, so... You know, I think 80% is pretty good for a book like this.
I agree.
Yeah, you know, the masters, they'll have read it multiple, many, many times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just open invitation for everybody else. You'll really appreciate it more if you know what we're talking about going into it. Like, seriously, this one I would say read beforehand because we'll also have extra reading material for after you listen to our episode. But that's coming out, I think, should be Sunday of whatever, you know, whenever this is released. Okay. All right, Clifford, back again, another ending.
Indeed we are.
Okay, so...
Ending in multiple ways, maybe.
Oh, yeah?
Wait, the Tour de France has come to an end.
Dude, that was epic. I could not believe it. Stunning performance. Stunning performance. The greatest...
For anyone not following, what was so stunning? What happened?
So it ended with... It looks like Primož Roglič, the top Slovenian... He was the best rider all race. It looked like, and he had the best team all race. It looked like he had the race locked up. But then all of a sudden, on the last day, it was a final time trial, which means everybody goes off a minute apart. And the guy in
they
second.
They race against themselves, basically.
Or against the clock, kind of, you know. Okay, and then, like, it all. Yeah. And so the guy in second place was actually another Slovenian, which is very rare because there's never been a good Slovenian cyclist before these two. And they were 1-2 in the Tour de France. He mm-hmm. started a minute... No, he started 57 seconds down on him for the day. And he beat him by 2 minutes in this time trial, which means he beat him by a minute and he took back all the time. He beat him by a minute for the yellow jersey. So he won the Tour that second to last day. And then the last day is just flat. So there was no chance to come and beat him. So wow. It was shocking ending. Like, it was literally the greatest time trial in the history of the bicycle. It was unbelievable.
Crazy.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Everybody was stunned for literally the entire 24 hours. Like, we woke up and we had to make sure that this was still real.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, not too much going on here. Yeah. Working like a dog.
What about the cats? How are the cats?
The cats are doing great. I guess there's no video to share one of them. They're very quiet when they meow. That's what I mean, which is very cute, but at like 3 p.m. for like 2 hours. They're funny. They every day I feel like they learn how to climb onto a new thing. They just learned how to get up into like the highest shelf of our closet. So I was reaching for a sweater this morning and found a cat just hanging out in the closet.
Nice. Cool. All right. So this was the King in the Golden Hall chapter. We already got the little part that we cut in telling you to read Beowulf. I finished editing that episode. I'm pretty happy with it. I think that's at least tied for our best that we've done. So
nice.
Get excited for that, because that one was really I think it was pretty fun to record, because it was fun to edit when we did the translations. Because they were significantly different.
Our two translations?
Yeah, like the token one and whoever your guy is. Yeah.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah. So
forgot about that. Yeah, that's good. When should we expect the Beowulf episode out?
Sunday night.
Okay, or cool.
Monday.
Stay
morning.
Tuned.
Yeah, who knows when. Sometime this weekend. Cool. But yeah, this has been kind of a... Yeah, kind of the usual, but that just means a long episode, so I don't know if we have to talk about anything else.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, y'all.